6.13, yes. And I repeated it in my summary, but yeah, that was where I got it from.
It's, to me, a fairly novel approach to start off with an issue like this in a panel this evening. Well, that's not a question, just an introduction.
Well,
a comment on
I don't know whether novel. Well, I mean, we always used to do that, didn't we? Before it was no longer required, so we didn't do it anymore. But I just have always felt that well, the driver going way back to original resource management plans was if there isn't a resource management issue, then you didn't address it, you didn't include any provisions on it.
Yeah.
And it was often the case in terms of people wanting to do economic activity, but there was no issues about that, so there was no provisions on that. What I'm trying to do here is like combine and encapsulate the complete question in one statement, which has got both sides of the question, or both parts of Section 5, if you like.
Well, the underlying assumption the ARA made through Section 5 is that people are perfectly entitled to do economic activities subject to the provisos, which is why plans have tended to concentrate on the provisos, I suppose.
Right, but there's, I think more latterly though, plans have responded to economic, social and economic development, and particularly in places where there are significant and special resources, given more guidance as to where it's more appropriate than not.
Yeah, I well remember the opening days of the RMA when the late Mr. Bruce Bauntwald was stumping the country, loudly proclaiming that the RMA was actually an economic planning enactment.
He came to Victoria University and told me that I was a law student at the time.
We had a tremendous clash with the Brisbane District Council and the MFE and Doc got heavily involved. So, is this approach a reversion to emphasising economic planning through a planning document?
No, I mean, obviously it's not in the provision, so it's only a means by which I...
Yeah, that's right. Well, that was going to be my next question, because it's not reflected anywhere in the outcome.
No, it's really underpinning my thinking as to what the issue is. further on down there, it's been my observation that often it's a case where you have a developer that buys some land and then they're simply focusing on their own proposed development for it. And so you get a set of provisions that are about how to enable that, albeit looking after the environment. What I've tried to do here is take that much wider and say the issue that I've stated is actually an issue for Queenstown.
And this morning you've actually gone on, I think, to say that if it's going to be addressed at all, it really needs to be addressed on a much wider basis. And that was going to be my next question. Isn't there tremendous leap from your issues, packet, directly into Queenstown Park?
Well, I mean, I've considered this proposal in terms of distinguishing it and what it can offer in answering that issue statement. That other potential proposals or plans could not do, even where they involve O&Ls. So I've looked at that complete question and said, and it primarily comes back to proximity to a large and growing marketplace and the connection to that marketplace in a really direct, straightforward way from the airport through Remarkable Park, missing out the utilisation of existing stretched infrastructure into and out of Queenstown itself. To me, that's one of the primary things. I mean, I list down in my supplementary statement the other things that I've relied on, which I'll just refer to. Yeah, so you've got that proximity. The other things I've listed are connections to existing ski field, proximity to other visit areas like Jack's Point and Chard Farm, single ownership of a large block, the benefits of the Queenstown Trail Network. And the unique landform providing a high country and remote experience within minutes of Frankton area. Again, that's a proximity thing, but I mean, if you do go on an exercise just required and say, well, okay, everybody else, let's put your hands up for trying to answer my issue statement, I find it hard to believe that this proposal wouldn't come out on top.
Or somewhere near it.
It isn't how you do the study, though, is it?
No.
You do a study differently. Has anyone done a study on the district-wide nature? Because this has been an issue for me as well, you know, that looking at proposals from various stations around the Lake Wapitiki Basin, each of them bidding for rural visitor zone or whatever, where's the overview?
Well,
is it in that tourism strategy?
Well, that's not something that
or not, or where is it?
I mean, the overview you wouldn't typically rely on a private proponent to do, would you?
No.
It was a council to do.
No, it's good.
And as I said, the council hasn't gone down that track. All I've just said is it's almost everywhere in the Wapitiki Basin now, it's inappropriate, and it's generally inappropriate elsewhere. And having made that large statement, which suggests there are, as was said in the King Sam case, I think, which obviously suggests there are some areas which are appropriate by the flip side of that statement, and who made that big statement, they've just been set on their hands.
Throughout these hearings, we've been looking at O&Ls, some of which seem to us perhaps less spectacular than this particular setting. So in terms of that policy you've just mentioned,
Well,
is this one of the more spectacular locations around Queenstown? So why is this one of them? Why is this particular site a rare, one of those very rare exceptions to the policy?
Well, in making that statement, you've immediately said that the whole of that R&L is the same, and Mr. Brown said that's not the case.
Yes,
he has differentiated those lower terraces from the rest of the O&L around.
Well, I'm a bit troubled by that because
And also, if you go to the Water Conservation Order, it also distinguishes, when you're talking about the Kawarra River, it distinguishes the part of the Kawarra River below the Arrow Junction as being more scenic and wild and just those rock landscapes and wild waters, etc. And so, if you look at Mr. Brown's analysis, I think he does identify that part of, I mean, he distinguishes the the Western Face from the Northern Face, and then he also distinguishes those tourist areas from the higher country as well, as being a place where development is appropriate.
But he does accept that it's all an ONL.
Yes.
But so, what are we saying? That it's all outstanding, but some of it's more outstanding than other things?
Or it's all outstanding, but some is less outstanding than others, if you want. Yeah. I mean, all we're saying is that the use is a differentiation.
Or that some parts are less effective than other parts. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, the whole... I mean,
anyway, definitely differentiate.
The number in the district is, you know, is extremely high percentages ONL. I mean, it simply cannot be all the same. Can
it's even going back to the Wesley case, he was a spectrum of naturalness to very high pristine, and then you have the cut off ONL. Now, so there's always going to be some spectrum here, I think. But I'll tell you something of the case of the sir, and then I'll talk to the person.
Going back to your issue statement. As a planner, I'd be more comfortable, having got to an issue, that if there was an examination of, well, what are the consequences of actually not addressing this issue, and what are all the alternatives before we dive straight into one specific proposal? Wouldn't that be reasonable?
Well, as I said, I mean, the council haven't done that.
No.
I don't see any proposals that they are going to do that and take the lead in this process.
Yeah.
So we're reliant on a private proponent doing an extensive exercise and coming up with a proposal on their own land, admittedly, that can demonstrate where development is appropriate. And it might not be as good as a district analysis, as I suggested, but it's the next best.
So what we've got is an issue statement and a proposal which contributes substantially to addressing that issue. Is that a fair categorisation?
Yes.
Okay. Did you actually consider an alternative strategy to this whole proposal? Simply just to say, well, here's a proposal and the effects are not too bad and they're appropriate. A much more simple approach.
On a different piece of land?
No, this piece of land. This whole proposal, just say, right, here it is. And for these reasons, the effects are acceptable. And therefore, we're entitled to put it forward.
That alternative being better than what we've put up?
Well, another way of doing it.
Right.
Without the complication of this issue statement.
I think
that's essentially the way Mr. Brown is approaching it.
Yes.
Funny he's not the overall planner, I accept that.
I mean, we have arrived at, in terms of the development, and I gather you're talking about the development areas as opposed to the Gondola itself.
I'm talking about the whole campus.
Right, okay. Well, just looking at the development areas, I mean, they are an iterative process. I mean, I don't know where QPL started. I mean, the first I looked at it was, there were the other RRs and RVs that were put up in the original proposal. And mainly on Mr. Brown's advice, but probably taking into account things like access, things were whittled down to what was seen to be better, more appropriate for the landscape.
Yeah, I think you say in your supplementary evidence that the landscape issue is the overwhelming issue for this proposal.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it has been an iterative process of whittling down and confining it. I mean, the nature of the process is it always gets more confined and targeted and sharper. You don't sort of expand it, it doesn't go the other way.
Question about planning technique, if you like. Objective setting. I've often reacted against objectives on the lines of, saying, essentially saying, the objective is to zone this area of land. And I've seen clearer examples than this. Because to me, it's very self-serving, and everything else follows from it, and it sits alongside all the other objectives, even though it may not be particularly consistent with them.
Well, I mean,
and I put that arguably, zoning is a method, so it's actually a policy that comes out of your objective, the zoning.
Because method of the effort, isn't it?
My answer would be that I think the objective statements follow the usual approach of stating a desired state or outcome that's to be achieved. They are statements of a desired state, and they follow up with policies that start with.
But why is the development of Queenstown Park an RMA objective? Now, why is it a legitimate objective under the RMA?
I think you need to read 44.2.1A and B together. And look at that in the totality. And if you do, not that my issue statement's in the plan, but I mean, it does respond to that need to actually, in a Section 5 way, provide a balance between what you're providing for while looking after the very important values of the land.
In fairness to you, I would say that in a first-generation plan, I wouldn't tolerate it for a moment. In a second-generation plan that has strategic objectives and policies, it's perhaps has less potential to cause damage.
Well, I mean, it's the Queenstown Park special zone, isn't it? So would you not expect to see something right at the front about what the zone is all about? What the zone intends to achieve? Coupled with the important values that it intends to prove to.
Well, I would expect to see objectives about important values, and even objectives about, in a generic sense, about economic benefit, commensurate with sustainable management. Anyway, that's...
But those objectives are all in Section 6.
Yes. Yeah. 44.2.1B is one of the few cases in the whole set of revisions that you actually mention an ONL.
And it just says landscape, it doesn't say ONL.
Well, it has ONL, and we all know that ONL means outstanding natural landscape. But it's a rare example, and to me, does it do much more than paraphrase Section 5? Section 6, sorry. And have regard for it as the lowest tier.
Well, I think you need to follow through the policies thereafter and and the matters of discretion as well. See where that goes.
Okay. Now, diving into the specifics, because you'll hear yesterday when we were discussing with Ms. Skidmore, and we were really testing her on the notion that RB3 is a rural character rather than an urban character. Put aside what you know of your client's aspirations for a moment and intentions, and imagine a worst case scenario under those provisions that you've got there. To what extent could we expect to see, I mean, the minimum, you can go to 12 metres in height as a controlled activity. How much 12 metre height, and what is the limit on the ability to cover the whole thing with 12 metre tall buildings? How is that restrained? And if you've got to that point, would it be urban rather than rural?
Okay, so the RV, the lower terraces up to 12 as RD, and then the upper terraces to 8. So the starting point is your comprehensive development activity consent, which I think you may have noted as one of the matters of discretion for distribution of additional height.
Yeah, there's a...
So...
In passing, there's a disparity between your summary of the provisions and your evidence, which doesn't mention that distribution, and the rule itself, which does. But that's not important.
Well, sorry, I'm answering the question. I don't see that's an RD. It's not a permitted activity standard. It's an RD matter for discretion.
What is
that distribution of additional height?
Additional height? So lower terrace above?
Above 8 metres.
Above lower terrace is 12.
12.
Upper terrace is 8.
So
it's an RD to do what?
Well, it's an RD to consider the distribution of height across that area. So the intention is in that comprehensive development activity consent, you would end up with a plan that indicated the distribution of height. So you might have a key landmark in a couple of places, a rural clock tower or something like that. And then elsewhere, height would be lower than the 12 metres. So two-storey buildings, one-storey buildings. Yeah. And only in some places would it be 12, or, as I said, possibly up to the 16 mark.
So what's the status of activities or buildings that don't comply with that initial plan?
It's restricted discretionary on the lower terraces. It's restricted discretionary from 12 to 16 above which it would be not compliant. But I go back to the comprehensive development activity consent, which provides for so you're looking at the layout, so the proposed location of commercial and community activity and the distribution of additional height are matters to consider and matters for discretion rather.
Yes, what I'm trying to understand is the effectiveness of that plan to control within its subsequent development.
Right. So
and what a developer would do, or would need to do, to depart from that initial plan.
Right. So if you are going to depart from that original framework consent, you could go back and have the whole thing reconsidered, which is again restricted discretion. But if you're not going to comply with that, there's your rule 4.5 44494. That's not compliant.
Just more fundamental than some of the matters that Richmond Up has raised. Just trying to understand the zone, Queenstown Park zone, is the relief is only seeking to apply it to the land that is owned by Queenstown Park. Is that true? That doesn't extend beyond that land.
Right.
So it doesn't include the council's unformed road between the land and the road.
No, I think there are, but you know, it's not the gondolway.
Yeah, ignoring the gondolway. Okay.
I think that the framework for development, when we've used the 4,000, obviously, the rural zone has assessment criteria for that sort of subdivision. I think the difference is we go a bit further than that for what happens both within and also around the outside of that activity area and between activity areas. That's where the consideration of additional indigenous planting and that sort of thing. But, I had a look at the rural zone provisions again. I wouldn't read them as saying that they definitely wouldn't happen in a rural residential subdivision. But I think we're very clear about that has to happen, as opposed to, well, it might just happen.
Mm, that's okay, just trying to get an understanding. And so the other area I'm wondering about is the area outside of the activity areas. In other words, the rest of the station.
Right, well away from the terrace.
Well, even on the terrace, no, it's not one of the pods, one of our activity areas. Are you seeing the basic resource management framework being a subset of the rural zone for that?
Yes. And as you will have read, with the addition of the restrictions on grazing the SNA and stocking rates above the contour. Oh, yes, I should, as per my summary statement, the first line in our activity table where it says any activity not provided for is discretionary, I'm now suggesting that it's non-compliant. And I say that because what it does is it brings emphasis to the fact that we've identified areas that are appropriate for some development. So it draws a stronger contrast between the areas that we've identified. Yes, that 44.4.1 activity is not listed. Non-compliance.
So it's upset with you, it's not even as it's just context about that activity, so do you mind if I speak to that just briefly? In discussion with Mr. Porter, there was a desire to have the ability to build maybe one or two farmhouses for the functioning farm, and that's why it was discretionary. We've said to you, and I've said to him, we're trying to lock in certainty of outcome here. I'm sorry, you were going to go to non-compliance and said that that's what you want, because we don't want that confusion in the rule. And he's accepted that change, understands that, because we want to clear the distinction between the COPs and outside. So that's the genesis of the discretionary activity status, and that's why, in terms of policy and rules following each other, you need to go to non-compliance. It's not anything to say.
I just have one, and it's about, this is small really, the rules that deal with grazing, for example. How are they enforceable? Because I've been thinking about how can a provision in a plan mandate a behaviour without some trigger to enforce it or to make that change happen?
I think you're probably thinking of existing use rights. You've got existing farming activity. So that's happening in a certain way now. There's the two line items that you're thinking of, which is excluding grazing from the ECNA. And the stopping range limitation.
But in a plan construction sense, plans don't normally do this.
No.
like saying you can't smoke in a service station.
You don't pull into one where someone is.
I'm simply saying that. I understand what you're saying, is that even the settling of a new zone on a piece of land doesn't mean that you're taking away someone's rights. I think it's a commitment of the landowner that those two standards come into being if this zone has become operative. Whether there's something that needs to be added in here that says it's almost like a sort of OGIA offering them.
Or then condition of consent, letting it as a condition.
Or the owner just goes and gets a QE2 covenant and writes these in, does it themselves because they want to. those kind of options. I couldn't see how you could make this work, this sort of approach work in a general sense in a plan, let alone.
And particularly the exclusion from stock from the ECNAs, they're important parts of the ecological offering to protect those areas.
But it's not all stock, as I understood it. It was sheep who needed to keep the weeds down, but you don't want the cattle under them, is what I understood. I'm just being petty, because I'm learning about a whole new ecology, you see.
On the ECNA, we're the two main tributaries of the Rashes Bear and the Harnes Creek. So a few things, cattle out of those areas, that's the major contaminant.
It's a question of the benefits that are being factored into your assessment of the desirability of the zone and how deliverable they are.
I think ecologically, in terms of what most people would notice, I think the bigger ecological gain would be the sort of commitment to indigenous planting in areas where it's gradually been reduced over time. That's what most people would see. People aren't going to look up there and go, oh wow, the stock aren't in that area anymore. But it's part of it, and it's important.
You could link it. The CDP could require or could indicate planting outside a pod. And you could link it to your CDP, your initial CDP, and as a condition of consent. Then it's a matter of monitoring, and of course might accept that, but it could be, if that's linked to the CDP, well, if started my degree, but you could have it as a condition of consent as a
board. I just like learning about how you put things together. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could you consider locking that in through some sort of covenanting approach?
You could have
even an open space covenant under the old Reserves Act.
We secure in public access on trails by way of covenant, and potentially you secure that outcome by covenant in the plan as well. But then it's a matter of timing and linking it to a consenting, the initial consenting, I think. The short answer is yes, you could. Then I just need to think about whether that's effective in terms of what Ms. Crawford is saying about checking, but it's a method you can use.
Thank you. That's all the questions. We will adjourn in 21.
Thank you so much. Oh, can I miss you on my closing? And I've the opportunity to do that now. I am seeking leave to do a closing. I've got some matters I'm not going to write home of legal submission. I'm not going to repeat myself. I understand the need to be concise. It would be anything new in terms of evidence. But one thing I still haven't got back to you on the decision on the water conservation order. I just, it's an excuse I haven't had time on. And I want to do that. I also want to look. I do want to briefly address you on the spectrum of your decision-making options. I know you understand that, but just in terms of scope and the issue you've raised about the rural land, the scary, the subzone, I'm giving some thought to that and what might be within scope in terms of cross-references and what mightn't be, and I'd like to look at that and maybe address that in closing. And the building line restriction, the scope issue. I haven't gone to the bottom of that. I just want to find where that is. And so it would be limited closing, so I don't keep going on and on about the evidence.
No, that's fine.
And that deadline.
For those sort of clarification matters, that's fine. And
I'd like to think it's to assist, but I am advocate too, but it's to try and close for those things off.
And the deadline remains the same?
Yes.
Noon on Wednesday the 13th?
Yes. Do you think it'll be a flight out today? Come back. Thank you, sir.
Okay. And that's all. Thank you.